You're listening to Red Setter, your roundup of Red Camera news from the crew at fxguide.com.
Hi, and welcome to this week's Red Center. I'm Mike Seymour, and I'm joined by a somewhat, how can I put this, remotely located Jason Wingrove. How are you, Jason?
I'm well, mate. Not as remotely located as you have been, but just down here at the ski fields in New South Wales. We're still waiting. I won't call them the ski fields. I'll call them the rain fields at the moment. Still waiting some sort of change in the weather here. Otherwise, it's just going to be Scrabble and DVDs at the moment. But hoping for a bit of skiing.
Yes,
and
I like...
You've been far... Sorry.
I just can't begin to get over the irony of you being down there in wet and cold conditions and me having just come back from 40-degree heat in China.
Oh, how was it? We haven't had a chance since you've been back. How was it?
No. Well, actually, before I do that, you were shooting last week, weren't you?
No, I was just down doing recce-ing and casting and location scouting and stuff. So I'm, as soon as I come back at the end of the week, I'm heading off again on Monday to go down and do shoot. So, so I haven't done shooting yet, but we'll do.
Well, as you guys know, we didn't actually put out a full episode last week. We're kind of late on this one, only because, as you just heard, Jason was in Melbourne, I was in China. Now, I was filming with the Red in China. In fact, we shot with the great... honour of being the first people to shoot Red on the Great Wall of China, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, there's some fantastic shots there, which were on the FX PhD blog. It was great to follow it along as you went. That looked great. So you got up there and sherpaed your way up the top and stayed overnight.
This is the thing that I hadn't really anticipated, being obviously, a dumbass. I figured that what would happen is that we'd drive up to some kind of, launching area that would be a nice sort of, car parky area, and then we'd climb from there up the Great Wall, which, couldn't be more than a couple of, and then we'd be on the Great Wall and we'd just get some great shots, and wouldn't that be fun? So we'd just take along all our camera gear. Now, we did hire some people to help lug it. What I hadn't anticipated was that we decided to go 3 hours outside Beijing to an incredibly remote location so that we could film without having a lot of tourists around. And so the road just kind of ran out. And at the end of the road, we then started just to walk until we got to the Great Wall, and then we started climbing it. And then when we got on it, we then climbed for another, 3/4 of an hour to get to the right spot for sunset. So to say that I was knackered was an understatement. I wasn't hardly carrying anything, yet alone 28 kilos worth of Red camera.
But you did travel light. You traveled pretty light, even though you were lugging Red and things, I guess.
Oh, yeah. No, totally traveled light, but this is the stupid part about it. We'd climbed all the way up on the top of the friggin' Great Wall to this perfect spot because we had some people that were facilitating us that actually were the same people that facilitated Survivor when they shot there for the American show, right? Survivor in China. So they were really experienced. So they said, look, this is a really great place to do sunset. So who are we to argue? We followed. Having shot sunset, we then climbed down off the darn thing all the way to the end of the road again, where we set up a trestle table and ate dinner, drank, and I decided, I'll come back to that. And then after dinner at about 10 o'clock at night in pitch black, we then climbed back up the mountain and up on the wall and up the other way because we wanted to have the optimum spot for dawn, which was at 4:30 in the morning, some 4 hours after we actually got settled. So it was pretty...
fantastic.
It was great fun. And the other thing was we were traveling there. It was about 3 hours drive. We went to the Ming tombs of the emperors with most of the emperors. Three didn't make it, but most of them are buried in this magnificent area. And during this walk around, we discovered that our hosts hadn't actually ever had cocktails. So I took it upon myself to convince them that what we should do is actually hunt around the outlying towns near the area we were to find anywhere that sold enough vodka and ingredients so that I could make cocktails. So not only did we have the Red camera on the Great Wall of China, but we had my version of Sex and the City, Cosmos on the Great Wall as well, which was kind of fun. Though I must admit, I totally regretted it when I started climbing it again at 10 o'clock at night to get back up the bloody mountain again.
So I'm more impressed with the first Cosmopolitans on the Red Wall.
Yeah, it was quite fun. And they're really good sports about it. Actually, I was really surprised how easy it was to find the vodka. The Cointreau was a little harder. The cranberry juice, near impossible. Especially when you're trying to translate cranberries and you've got no idea what the Chinese version of that is, and they've never even seen a cranberry. But, you know, I have great shots of me using, well, anyway, we getting ice wasn't that easy either. I might add, we had to call ahead and have people rush ice to us. But it was all good fun. And then we
I admire your perseverance. Well, yeah, so what did they think of the cocktails then? The first cocktails I've ever had there.
They really liked them. They downed, I think we finished about a bottle of, almost a full bottle of vodka and another of Cointreau, and obviously wiped out all of the available ice at base camp. In addition to the beer we were drinking, we had a good time. And interestingly, we met up with some people from Edinburgh who actually had I'm not making this up. They actually had a torch from the relay race of the Olympic. So we actually got to muck around with the, use that as a giant cigarette lighter. So that was
right.
Fun.
I saw a picture of you holding the torch. I did wonder whether you'd accosted the rally or something.
Yeah, so that was good fun. And we then shot again with the red mounted in a car. And then again we did, which was probably my favorite. Well, I don't know. That's actually not true. But it was one of my favorites. We shot Kung Fu fighting in Beijing at the end of the week. So we shot green screen with these martial arts Kung Fu experts who, let's face it, if I wasn't feeling like, you know, old and flabby from climbing the Great Wall, standing next to these incredibly cut, incredibly fit Kung Fu guys made one feel like they just got a different body from me when the bodies were being handed out.
So that this is all for upcoming FX PhD class.
Yeah, we just announced our new term at FX PhD. And so, you know, we have four terms a year. And the new one's just launched, literally on the 1st of July. And we have, gosh, you know, another 20 or 30 new, or other 30 courses to offer this term, including some ones that may be of interest to people listening to the Red podcast. Because last term we did a course called DOP. And the DOP course discussed things like subtext and the character's point of view on the plot at any particular point and how to film that and how to pick lenses and how to sort of design shots to convey the basic subtext and stuff that was going on, as well as a bunch of other things to do with lighting and cameras and stuff. And we also did a Red course. And so this term, what we decided to do was actually combine those two very, very popular things into what we call a 300-level course. We have 100-level, which is kind of introductory, though certainly not for a novice, for somebody that's, you know, knows what they're talking about. A 200-level, which is just standard general professional level, and then the 300, which is kind of more expert-y. And the 300-level course we're doing for Red is, I think, kind of pretty interesting, actually. We've discussed it with the guys at Red, and we're going to take Build 16, and we're going to say to ourselves, what is it going to take to do a mid-level feature film using the Red? And yeah. So the DOP course, led by Ben Allen, who's a very successful DOP, we're going to put together everything you would need to do a feature film, work out what it would take, how you'd handle the data, how you'd test it, rate it, shoot it, do it. We'll obviously still be doing stuff in terms of lighting, framing, and stuff with the Red, but we'll be putting together an entire project as to, well, this is what it would take to do a feature. Then we're going to shoot a test sequence, and that test sequence we're actually running out to film. And then members who are interested in the course can additionally buy not only the R3D files, because we obviously hand those out normally, but you'll give them a whole lot of them on a disc if you want the entire lot. We'll also give you out an SR tape with the material transferred to HD and graded.
Wow.
Also, we're going to run out to film, and we'll give you a copy of the print of the film. And if you want to, you can actually get a neg. So we'll copy the neg via Interpos and Interneg. So you can actually, if you were doing your own project, you'd say, well, you know, I learned a lot about this workflow from the tests that were done by these guys. And not only that, but I can show you the neg, project the film for you, and run the SR tape for you if you want to have a look at it on an A-grade monitor here at my facility. And I think that's a great service to be offered. So you really
Fantastic.
Get a chance to, because, I mean, obviously doing that test, and on that test we'll have some 35 output as well as some Red from the same setup and some other
Excellent.
Things like that. You'll just be able to run a reel and get a really good idea about what the Red actually looks like when it's projected. Because it's really, as my father once said to me, I think I've quoted this before, you can read the entire works of Sigmund Freud, but sooner or later you've got to take a girl out on a date. And nothing actually beats having a look at stuff. And the number of times people ask me, well, how does it stack up when you project it? And we thought this was a good way of doing that. So we're very enthusiastic to offer that course.
Fantastic. So you're covering a little bit of the DIT side of things as well.
Oh, totally, yeah. And we have some guys contributing to that that were off the feature that was just shot with Red in Melbourne, so that's really good. So they've just literally come off a major feature film. So that's just one of the courses we've got on offer. And the other one that's of interest that I'm actually going to shoot on Wednesday, which is about when this will go up on FX Guide, is we're heading to Adelaide to shoot with Anifex on doing miniatures and stop frame animation. So we're taking the Red down and putting it on their motion control rig, and we're actually doing a whole thing on stop frame animation. And you know, Jason, I actually started in stop frame animation.
Did you? What were you doing in stop frame animation?
My first film was a claymation, and then I got funding from that, got a grant from the Film Commission, and that was the start of my career. So I have a big sort of soft spot for stop frame animation, and just love it as an art form. And these guys are just unbelievably good. They've been going for years.
They are the kings of stop frame in Australia, at least, and worldwide. They do a lot of work.
So it'll be really good to sit down with them to both discuss all of the things to do with, you know, I actually was lucky enough to hook up with them already, and we discussed a whole bunch of stuff. And they have some just amazingly cool, and I can't begin to believe I didn't think of it before, type tricks. And one of my favorites was they had a forest scene. And, of course, they wanted it to have low light, but they needed lots of light to get depth of field. And so the inherent problem you've got is that you want to have the depth of field to make it not look like a miniature, but you want it to also be very moody and dark. Yeah. And so they simply painted the shadows on the side of the trees. So all these trees look like they've got bright light on one side and dark on the other. And in fact, all those shadows are literally just airbrushed onto the sides of the trees to give the impression that they're very dark on one side. And they were like, yeah, that took us about, you know, an hour, and just saved us a ton of money. And I was like, you guys are just... So it's everything you love about filmmaking, you know, inventive, clever...
Yeah.
And yet, of course, immensely professional. I mean, these guys literally hot glue their tripods to the floor, to the concrete floor, when they start a shot, and not until the shot's ready do they actually break with a mallet the tripod off the floor. And
I love it.
They're just dedicated to their art. So I love working with any filmmaker that's really dedicated to their art.
I love that sort of, I won't call it paperclip and rubber band sort of technology, but it's becomes quite simple, because I suppose that kind of stuff almost becomes like a bit of a stills shoot, because essentially you're kind of still shooting stills. It comes quite a bit of a small crew, and everyone sort of does about five jobs, and you know, I really sort of love it. That's kind of how I sort of started out in focus pulling department. I sort of always was working with an ex-stills guy, so I love all that kind of stuff.
It's a real discipline to be sure, and we really respect them for it. So that's good fun. And as I said,
fantastic.
We did the kung fu fighting stuff in China on Friday. I want to thank the crews up there, because they were terrific. But I'm going to discuss that a bit more, because after we go through the news, we're going to have an interview with one of the filmmakers who's done feature work in this country with the camera. And then coming back after that, we're going to do our shutter discussion. And that ties into what we were shooting with the Kung Fu, because we were shooting with reduced shutters and high speed with the Kung Fu at like 120 frames a second. So we'll discuss all that. And then later in the show, we have a Red Room. And do you want to tell us who's coming up at the end of the show in our Red Room?
Yes, we have. This time we visit Tokyo, and we meet a guy called Paul Leeming, who just showed a few quick little beautiful screenshots of a film clip he did on Red and on Red User, and I just kind of went, wow, the images looked fantastic. And so I thought, great. I was wanting to obviously go around the world with the Red Room and try and, you know, do, you know, Americans, and I've recorded stuff from, you know, people from Austria and stuff. And so I thought, great, Tokyo, and the guy is an Aussie. So, haven't quite got round the world yet. So we've got interviews with two Aussies today. So, we'll work our way around the world. Which I've got a bit of a backlog. So it's been some great interviews in the can.
Now, also point out that right after that Red Room at the end of the show, we have our giveaway from this week's sponsor, which is Monster Cine, who have a really cool giveaway for us. So hang around for that. But before we get to that, we need to start with the news and then on to our interview with Peter Holland. So are you okay to do the news from there, or would you want me to... How are you sort of placed up there?
No, I'll do it from here. Okay, so I guess we are pretty much about to hit July, so we'll probably start to get into 2000s of the camera delivery, 2001 to 2400. Maybe around by the time this goes to air, it will start to kick over into the next batch. I can't imagine. I know of a few people who have been getting their cameras, and they're in the real late 1900s. So I'm sure any second we're going to start to kick over. 16 gig CF cards, which obviously were announced last time on our last episode. That has now been they've been announced. There will be mid to late July availability. So that'll be good. I'm sure they'll sell a whole bunch of those.
Yeah, there's been a lot of interest in those 16 gig cards, and people have asked me, as they did on this last trip, whether it's okay to use non-RED cards. And I just want to put a plug in for RED here, because I think it's really valid. Firstly, if you price out the cards from RED, you'll actually find they're really pretty price competitive. The guys have not marked them up. You might, you know, make a guess that with many of these things, it's the case that if you buy the non-branded one, it would be a lot cheaper, but that isn't the case.
Yeah, I'm sure they're not just taking them off the shelf. I'm sure they're working with the card manufacturer and working with the firmware of the card and making it, you know, work with the way that the data needs to be written to it, I'm sure.
Well, the other thing is you are guaranteed of getting a performance level. So even though it might meet the specs on paper, RED actually pour through those cards to make sure that they hit their spec. And so as a consequence, you're not only getting a reasonably priced card for the, you know, the capacity and the performance, but you're pretty much getting a guarantee of the better ones of the batch, if that makes sense.
So yeah, you know, we know it's not an exercise. It's not a marketing exercise. These cards are. If there was a card available, I'm sure everyone would know about it. There's a lot of cards being tested, and this is. I think you know, buy any other card at your peril, I think.
Well, I think the other thing is, you know, there's this idea of possibly saving a few bucks, but I've never heard anyone on set say, you know what, don't buy Kodak film. Buy Bob's film because Bob's got some really good 35mm. Okay, it may not be in date, but it'll be great. Yes. Don't worry about it. And if it's not quite right, I mean, you know, we'll save a couple of dollars.
Yes, film is... Let's just everybody try and remember how much film costs. You know, I'm pretty sure when we quote it out, it's like $1.50 Australian, $1.75 or something a foot. That's just purchased and processed. You know, so... 400 feet, you know, 1,000 feet is, you know, $1,500, $2,000 for, you know, for 10 minutes. So, you know, let's not quibble about a few bucks for a CF card.
Now, the other thing is that since we spoke last, RED Support has released not only an update to RED Alert, but also to RED Cine. And initially, RED Cine was not released. But it has been released, which is really good and something that a lot of people have been after. There are still some bugs with the beta stuff that we're looking forward to having fixed to do with ISO and stuff. So it is beta software, and I know a lot of people are going straight to it, but you know, do be warned. It is beta, and it is really not, you know, something that I would jump into prime time on unless you've had a chance to test it and shoot with it a lot. And we certainly found some minor anomalies when we were shooting last week. And, you know, had I not already run some stuff, I'd have kind of freaked out on set.
Now, were you running the latest version of Build 16? Because there has been, since the last episode when they launched Build 16 itself, there's been a little update to it, 3.1.5. As at time of broadcast.
Yes, we were running the latest version, absolutely.
Okay.
And and we'll be running the latest version at the end of the week when we go over to Adelaide as well. So, it's a good release. I'm not saying that it isn't. I'm just saying that just be warned that there are a few hiccups that you need to keep an eye out for.
Yeah. Now, just very quickly with that update, obviously that little update added functionality for the 16 gig cards for when they arrive. And I think one other cool thing, which I haven't seen yet, maybe you, Mike, is that when you're booting up, you can now actually... You get video while you're booting up, is that right?
I know, and it really took my... was one that I hadn't... You know, I hadn't read that. I just hadn't obviously read it. I just had loaded up the software. I mean, I'm sure I'd scanned the list, but it didn't sort of click. And so I'm on set, and we're switching on the camera, and suddenly there's a video feed, and I'm like, "Where's the playback coming from?" And they're like, "Well, from the camera." So the camera's still booting, and I'm, and we got, how can that? Cool. Okay, that must have been something I missed.
Excellent. And 1080p out of the HDMI, that's new, isn't it? Because it was 720p or something. Is
yeah,
that right?
This is on playback mode. This is live. So you play back at 1080p. And the playback mode is a big underline there. But hey, that's fine. And we certainly had a Panasonic HD monitor on set when we were shooting up in China. Not on the Great Wall, where we were shooting with minimal amounts of stuff, I must say.
Just take the LCD.
Just the LCD and the cocktails.
Exactly.
Okay, and so gear-wise, Jace, what's happening?
There's a couple little cool things tied in with our little giveaway with Monster Cine. They've got a couple of good, cool little things coming in the next sort of few weeks. You can order them. They have a cool little thing called Quick Keys, which is really just basically a little adjustable, kind of like little kip locks. You know, those adjustable locks for handles.
This basically means that one less on use of an Allen key.
Exactly. I just can't believe how many Allen keys there are on a Red camera. So this basically you take out your Allen keys, and this is for the side handles. They are bringing out another sort of version of these little stainless keys for the the grab handles, the Red handles, and that'll be out in a couple of weeks. But at the moment, it's just for the side handles, and they're about $46 for a pair. Very cool, very little. You can adjust them, and then you can sort of slide the handle left or right to get it out of the way, or to be able to sort of nip it up if there's something in the way. Very cool, very simple, but definitely something that's needed.
Absolutely. I wish they were a little cheaper. $46 for a screw does sound a bit, but I guess it's a pair. But still.
They're very nice. When you see the shots, if you've got the shots there, they're very, very, very nicely machined and very nicely done. They're stainless, so they're not going to bust. I mean, Red do sell a set of five, I think, little tiny adjustable kip, I guess they call them kip handles, which are, they're really nice too. They're cool. This is just another alternative to that. But it's great. I think Monster Cine, they're really, really, really thinking.
I think they're a good company.
The other thing they've just launched is another remote start stop. This one's quite interesting. It really is very simple, just a big stainless steel button with an on off light. But the cool thing about it, one of the cool things about it, is that you can really extend it, and you can extend it with 3-pin XLR cables. That's really cool. If you run out of stuff, quick, just go make friends for a change with the sound department, and just run standard XLR. 3-pin audio cables, and these guys had it out on a big Arcala crane. These things are almost like the biggest cranes you can get, 80-foot, and they had it out even further than that. They had it out to about 125 feet over four connections, so they had four of these big audio cables all joined in, and could running it with no problems in extreme weather. So very cool, very simple. That is, I haven't got the price here. It's a couple of $100. I think it's
$316 US.
Right, there it is, $316 US. The initial qualities on both of these are going to be limited, so get in there with the order. Sales at monstercine.com. It's not on the website yet. They're hoping in the next few days it will be up there. A couple of cool things to have a look at. Another piece of kit to
make. Now, we're about to go to our interview with Peter Holland, who was the DOP on Nothing Man, the first feature certainly shot in this country. And then after that, we're going to have our Shutter discussion and then Red Room. But just set up the interview for us. You got to talk to Peter. Obviously, I know Peter as well. Great guy. Do you want to set the interview up for us?
I just visited him on set. He was prepping for his next film, again, to be shot on Red. Nothing Man, yes. On the front page of red.com is a link to a good interview with him. For feature Nothing Men, and it's really cool guy, and here it is. Okay, on the front page of Red's website for about the last month has been a link to an article on the feature film Nothing Men, which was the first Red feature shot in Australia, and I'm joined today by Peter Holland, the DP of that job. Hey, Pete.
Hello, mate. How you doing?
Thanks for your time today. You're sort of testing today, so thanks for having a chat with me between things.
Yep, no, you're very welcome.
Okay, Nothing Men was shot in October 07, which is obviously pretty early days in the Red scheme of things.
Yeah, the cameras were pretty fresh off the production line when we got them. They were still beta built, the cameras. I think they've all since gone back to the factory and been replaced.
Right.
We're also shooting with firmware build 8. We're on 15 now, Then it was a, you know, the struggle for us was to actually build two cameras and get them configured in a production system, that we could use on a film. All the accessories you need, remote focuses, remote wirelesses, all that kind of stuff. Issues then were we couldn't actually get enough power out of the camera to actually power all the accessories, so we had to have a separate V-Lock battery supplying all the accessories on the camera. There was no viewfinder. We still don't have a viewfinder, but we're hoping to get one tomorrow. We also had an issue where, because we didn't have a viewfinder, we were using slightly larger monitors, Transvideos, which I think were 8-inch. We had to use a standard definition down converter on the camera, which was feeding that Transvideo, and then that Transvideo was also splitting off for any hardwire and monitoring that we did occasionally. So it was big and it was bulky and it was heavy and it was cumbersome and there were lots of cables and
rubber band and paperclip technology.
Right, cable ties galore.
And you had no hard drives.
We didn't have any hard drives. We only had cards, which about 4.5 minutes record time, 4K.
Yeah. So you shot the whole film on CF cards?
We shot the whole film on CF cards. We had quite a few. We had two cameras. We had 10 cards. But we had a great team. Our clapper loader, Hugh Rutherford, was fantastic, and so was our data wrangler, the turnaround. We were never waiting on cards. That was and we were shooting a lot of footage. I think our first day on set, we counted 36 setups with two cameras and big dialogue scenes between six actors. A lot of it sort of around tables, walking around tables and this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But that was all a lot of fun. Well, the great thing about it, even though the cameras were really heavy and not really that ergonomic at that stage, we were mostly on operating off a mini jib, or both cameras were on mini jibs,
right.
Or we had one camera on an AR Revolution Steadicam type rig.
Right. As well. Because what I can see from sort of some of the footage and stills I've seen, it's very much a sort of a theatrical kind of. Was it originally a play or?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So it's all sort of essentially you're all in the same location.
Mm. So we shot it. We shot the whole film in 18 days, which is quite amazing.
Wow.
I saw a preview screening last week at a film festival. I actually couldn't believe that we actually did that much coverage in 18 days. It was quite amazing. About 60% of the film was shot on one location, which made that possible. Yeah, it did have a kind of... It was a play originally. It did have a kind of theatrical bent. I tried to move it away from that a little bit without going, too gritty handheld, but coverage evolves throughout the film because, especially when you're in one location with, six actors, over 60% of the film, you kind of want to develop the coverage throughout the film to kind of reflect the emotion of the scenes.
Yeah.
So you don't want to bring out your big guns too early and start off using all your favourite tools or techniques. So you sort of weave those in at the appropriate moments, and at the same time keeping a solid, consistent style throughout that holds the audience as well.
Right. So, yeah, you mentioned the AR Revolution, is it? Can you take us through that rig? Because it's really unusual. I'd never seen it before.
Yeah, with the AR, it's... which AJ owns and operated. It's an amazing little Steadicam because it's basically got a roller cage on the end of an arm, which is kind of an extension of a Steadicam. And so that almost acts like a gyro head, so the camera is always stable, and so you can just put it in places that you couldn't really with a Steadicam.
So it's like a mini jib on the end of a Steadicam arm, basically.
I mean, somebody thought it was a bit like a techno crane on the end of a Steadicam, and it's something like that. It's not either of those things, but it's it does afford you a lot more latitude. And one of the great things about it is going from low mode to high mode is not a de-rig and a rebuild. It's a case of just moving the arm, and you're on the ground, or you can go, I think, to 8 foot. To the centre of the lens.
Right.
They're really versatile, really quick. The time savings, as opposed to using standard Steadicam, would be pretty bloody good.
So what was the decision to go red? Obviously it was a very brave one. How did that happen?
Well, I kind of went red because I could. The alternatives were shoot tape-based HD. And initially that's what we were going to do, but the shoot got put back by a few weeks, and that meant it was just touch and go whether we could get the Reds in the country on time through Limac and ready to go. We always had two Vericams on set, which Limac kindly gave us, a whole complete system of two cameras. So if there ever was a problem, we had a backup that within 15, 20 minutes we could have two cameras up and running, and we could carry on shooting, and which we'd never had to do.
Excellent.
Well, it came closer. We thought it was coming closer at one point. I think the classic story was actually on the pre-shoot day. We did a shoot day, and we went out to this park, and it was lush, verdant, high detail, leaves, grass, this kind of stuff. And we'd finished the scene. We were a little bit ahead of time. I had this gorgeous shot I wanted to do, and the cameras both bodies would not record. They just refused to record. And so,
both on the same day decided to have the same issue.
Yeah, yeah, on the same shot. So we were a bit worried about that. But when we got back to the, you know, the studio, the camera crew got on the phone to Red, and Red had immediately emailed us a firmware update because it seemed that this problem had been encountered, and the sensor just wasn't conditioned to accept high detail green images.
Just literally locking up because of the imagery it was trying to capture.
Yeah, well, I guess all their testing had been done in the car park in southern sunny California, and you know, they hadn't been out to a bloody rainforest. You know, I mean, I mean, this is the thing. I mean, we had to, you know,
it's build eight.
Yeah, we was build eight, and with beta cameras, so we were quite. You know, I mean, we were up to the challenge, and nobody lost their heads, and we never lost any time shooting.
Well, obviously, you enjoyed the experience enough to order your own Red.
That's right. Well, I actually ordered my own Red ages ago, about 18 months ago or something. So I was, I was a pretty early reservation holder. It was curious because I was, you know, it was the Nothing Man was going to be the test as whether I went through with it, and you know, because the camera itself is quite cheap, but everything that goes with it, you know, adds up to, you know, quite a lot of money. And I've never been prepared to buy a camera system before because I've always, you know, there's never been a system that I felt, you know, was good enough for most jobs, especially, you know, a system that would anyway challenge film. But after shooting on Nothing Man, I, you know, with these cameras, I was quite confident that this is worth pursuing. And and I've bought it and I've taken delivery, and yeah, it's all good.
And we're here testing, you're about to shoot your next film.
Yeah, Cedar Boys, a gritty ethnic gang film set in Sydney. And this is a very different style again. We're going for very kind of obvious camera coverage. We're doing in-camera zooms, pans. It's kind of almost like, almost observational. It's almost at times the camera is almost like a witness to the drama rather than being a, you know, hidden witness showing the audience what's going on. So that's quite exciting. But that's also presented challenges as well because it's 90% handheld. Finding 4K zooms, 35mm zooms that we can use, you know, to get the range handheld has been, you know, quite an issue. So we actually ordered a kit of Super 16 lenses, and so for, you know, specific scenes we'll be shooting 2K. We're trying to avoid 2K at night in low lit areas, in the dark, that kind of stuff.
Super 16 zooms because they're small and they're lightweight,
and we can record 2K with those.
Right, yeah. I see. Because when you go to 2K, then you get the right coverage for the lens.
That's right. Yeah. So if we want to shoot an 18mm scene on 4K, but then we decide to go to 2K, we actually need a 9.5mm lens. And but if we were to put a 10:1 zoom on 4K in 4K mode, the lens is ginormous and just impossible to handhold and operate. So by going to 2K means we use Super 16 lenses, which are actually shorter, smaller, and wider, and give us the same range but in 2K.
So obviously, 2K, you're sort of losing that 35mm depth a little bit, but if you're on the long end of the lenses anyway, then you're sort of, it's not quite so much of an issue.
Yeah, no, that's right. And the thing is, we'll be probably zooming, in some shots, we'll be zooming through the whole range of the zoom. Yeah. But 2K in good light with a reasonable exposure, you know, polishes up very well in the film transfer with the test we did on, we shot a lot of 2K on Nothing Man for overcranking purposes. And that stuff does, you know, in well exposed, you know, areas, it really does come up, you know, very well, you know, through the 2K film scan.
Going back to Nothing Man, obviously the post-production would have been breaking just as much ground there, I guess, as you would have been on set.
Yeah, no, it was very interesting. Obviously, it was a big learning curve, and luckily we had a fantastic colourist, Warren Lynch from Intercolor.
Yeah.
He's just fantastic. And
Lord of the Rings.
He did All the Rings. And also, I mean, with tapeless workflows, your colourist is almost... his job has now expanded, and his field of responsibilities is so much greater. He's your conformist, he's your archivist, you know. I know Mike Seymour likes to call this person your responsible adult. And I noticed that Warren, for once, has got a head credit on the Nothing Man, and, you know, and I think it's so deserved, you know.
Wow, at the beginning.
And so Warren was very good at coming to the challenge. We didn't really have any post workflow problems either. We never lost footage. There was no majors, and it kind of flew through.
Well, obviously, this is going to be a luxurious shoot now, having the hard drives and Build 15, and this is streets ahead from what you've had to deal with in Nothing Man.
Yeah, it's really good. And we've just been testing the red drives under car mount situations and going over speed humps.
Yeah, I saw that before. I just looked over and just, hang on a second, you're doing car rigs with the red drives.
So far we haven't had a frame drop out.
Wow.
I'm really happy about that, because obviously driving down a freeway or going through a harbour tunnel or something, where we're going to be shooting, and only being able to record 4.5 minutes or having to revert to 2K at night is not ideal. So having the drives and knowing that you can, if we need to, we can record as much as we want. Obviously, we'll be rotating the drives and downloading them as quickly as possible.
Are you wrapping those drives in something, or bubble wrapping them, or just...
I think all we did was we put the drive, just mounted it. We didn't put it in the cradle because we think that will vibrate.
Yep.
So we just put it on the top bars at the very back of the camera and just ratchet straps it, not too tight, and with a little bit of 1/4-inch foam underneath it, and that seems to be fine. My guess is if you put it in the cradle off the back of the camera, that would start vibrating and shaking the drives, and I don't think that would be ideal. But locked to the camera, I think locked to a limpet mount, locked to a car, and these are sports cars, they've got very hard suspension, low profile tyres.
Sure. And no drop frames?
No drop frames.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for taking the time today, Pete. I really appreciate it. You've got a very busy day and obviously a busy few weeks ahead. So when can we see Nothing Men?
I don't know. We had a preview screening at a festival last weekend, which went down really, very well. But because it was made independently and they didn't have to get a pre-sale, they're not in a rush to make that decision. They're not for the next couple of weeks at least.
Fantastic. Okay. Where can people find you, Pete?
I guess on IMDb, Peter A. Holland. Otherwise, showreelfinder.com. Just look for DPs and Peter Holland.
Fantastic. Thanks, mate. Good luck with the shoot.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for that interview, Jason. That was really good. And as I said, Peter Holland, great guy. Just somebody that's really dedicated, I guess, to the craft, and has been on board with Red from day one. Incredibly enthusiastic about, but also quite, brutally honest when it comes to whether it's good or bad and how it fits together.
Actually, I think I was just remembering, if you go to that link here, we mentioned Showreel Finder, where that one of the shots on there for Unwired is all stop motion, and he did all the stop motion on his Red. So that's pretty cool. It's worth having a look at. It's really well done.
Yeah, no, definitely. So let's now talk about shutters. We wanted to get into this and explain things. We obviously each week like to tackle a different subject and give you kind of sort of geeky depth to it. And this week... this is something that came up 2 weeks ago. We didn't cover it last time because of the Build 16 discussion, so it makes sense to get back to it. And a number of people have sent us emails and asked us questions to discuss shutter angle and how it works. And so let's get into that now. And I'll try and cover some of the stuff, but obviously, Jason, you've got a lot of experience with shooting with both Red and film cameras and what it means in the film world. To have
I'll try and tackle it from that perspective, because obviously what we have is there's two sides to this. Obviously, I guess you've got Red, which in a way sort of approach it from a more stills kind of mindset, I suppose you could say, with some of the settings. And there's obviously a lot of people who've come from the film side of things who are trying to get our head around the way it works, because obviously we're so used to film cameras being a mechanical thing where your shutter speed and your frames per second are like pretty much bolted together because it's all the same piece of moving equipment. So it's a real new world to sort of have these two independently controllable pieces of kit to change your frames per second totally independently to your shutter speed or link them together in a film way. So
I guess there's actually three things that we need to flag, because if it was that simple, I guess it would be one thing, but actually there's a third aspect to this, which is the rolling shutter. And the rolling shutter produces its own set of artifacts, problems, and differences from film cameras, and certainly it's something that we're primed to talk about today. So let's get into that. So basically what happens is the camera itself is able to open and close to expose the, quote, film/sensor, And if it makes sense in a film camera to say that it's running at 24 frames a second, it's not sensible to say that it can actually open up and let the film see the daylight for 1/24 of a second, because obviously in a film camera it has to take time to actually pull down the film ready to go for the next frame and then open up again. And so in a film camera we traditionally run with 1/48 shutter. In other words, even though we're going through at 1/24 frames a second, you need at least that half that time just to get the film in place ready for the next shot. So as a consequence, we have 1/48. But in the film world, we quote that as a degree, don't we?
Yeah, that's right. Your shutter obviously being the arc of a circle that 180 essentially, or 180 or 172 degree shutter at 24 or 25 frames per second will give you a 40th or 48th or a 50th of a second.
Now, staying with film for a second, in something like Saving Private Ryan, they actually decreased the shutter or reduced the shutter angle so that the film was actually getting less light. Now, the reason for doing this is really simple. If a ball is flying through the air and you open up for 1/48th of a second, then however far that ball moves in 1/48th of a second is the motion blur of the ball. Now, on a video camera, it can do the exact thing that I described a film camera not being able to do, which is pretty much open all the time, except from when it's changing frames. And so you would get, you know, 1/24th of a second worth of the ball flying through the air, another 1/24th and another 1/24th. This actually produces a smoother motion, but it tends to give what we see as a video or smeary look if we're used to film. Go to a film camera and you can only do 1/48th, and so the ball has, you know, obviously a certain amount of blur. But as you go and decrease the shutter, obviously you're affecting the exposure. But if we compensate for that, what happens is that the ball becomes increasingly less blurred and sharper. So in Saving Private Ryan on the beaches, to give the sense of incredibly violent, shuddering, horrendous kind of impact from the bombs and stuff, they shot with a reduced shutter. So as things were flying around the screen, they seemed to be very staccato-y because they didn't have much motion blur. Now, because it was a film,
all the debris and all the dirt and dust is all frozen. It gives a really amazing look, and they would definitely have gone to something like a 90-degree shutter or a 45-degree shutter, or even smaller.
Yeah, and of course, as we said, the exposure then changes. So obviously, if you're going to have the shutter open for only half of what it normally is, you're going to lose a stop, and a quarter, and you've got two stops, and so it makes sense to do that on the beaches of Normandy when you can get some reasonable light down the lenses. But it's not an inconsequential thing that as you start going for these higher shutters, you're going to have a problem that's going to either be solved by exposure just in terms of opening up, or you're going to have to change the ISO of either the stock or the rating of the camera. So let's assume that that makes sense, everybody. Let's assume that the idea of reducing the shutter makes sense. There's one other thing we need to be concerned about, which is panning speeds. And maybe you could just run us through what happens there, even on a film camera with panning and strobing.
Yeah, well, obviously, the film equivalent of rolling shutter is essentially is strobing. And you're seeing all the time, if you see a camera panning over a vista or over sort of a landscape, if you just pan that little bit too quickly, you get this real, I can only really describe it in the word strobing, really, which is what it's called. It just, you sort of get a bit of a staccato, sort of almost a skipping look to the frame. And that's really obviously caused by panning too fast. Now, in the American Cinematographer Manual, there's sheets and pages on recommended, you know, panning speeds, depending on what lens you've got and what frame rate you're going and what shutter speed you've got. So for instance, if you're on a 50mm lens at 25 frames a second with a 180 degree shutter, you should really take 23 seconds to do a 90 degree pan. And obviously, if you've got a wider lens, it's a lot less. There's definitely rules in the film world to be able to avoid or minimize this strobing, which is really essentially similar, I suppose, to the artifact we see in rolling shutter.
Actually, I'm gonna call you on that one. I don't think it's the same as rolling shutter, and I'll tell you why in a second. But I hit that same artifact, the film one, when I was shooting with motion control in England, and we had a camera going down a guitar fret, and of course on the stop frame animation type nature of the motion control rig, we couldn't see what was going on until we, you know, went and looked at the film and then saw it running and started seeing this. And of course, it just ran at a tailspin until we just realized that we'd broken the rule of the panning speeds, and it was just a stupid thing in the way we'd programmed the motion control rig. Okay, let's discuss rolling shutter now for a second, and I'll tell you why I think it's different, because what you have in the rolling shutter is different to what you have, for example, in a CCD camera. Let me just explain what happens. In a CCD camera, you kind of flood the sensor effectively with light at all levels and at all points on the sensor at the one kind of moment. And then that shutter effectively opens and closes, and all the information that was there disappears into the image, and, you know, away you go again to the next one, right? So it's an idea of effectively acting pretty much as you'd expect that it would, and you don't get, you know, much in the way of artifacts, and that's all fine. Now, as you said, the RED acts much more like a stills camera. It uses a CMOS chip. Now, whereas a CCD uses what we call a global shutter, in the sense that it's happening to the sensor pretty much all the way across the board at the same time, the CMOS kind of works its way down from the top of the screen to the bottom, and that's quite different. And the reason it's quite different is that if you think about a panning shot where I'm rapidly panning left or right, while the, say, door frame may be just entering top of shot when the scan starts moving down, rolling down the screen, by the time it gets to the bottom of the screen, the door may have seriously moved into frame. And this will mean that the door frame at the top of frame, in this one single frame, is touching the edge of frame at the top. By the time the camera's got to the bottom, it's moved, the actual physical camera's moved so much that the door frame is now ending a few, whatevers, into the picture. This literally means that the door frame looks like it's leaning over. It looks like it's skewed. And I'm not talking about something that happens over multiple frames. I mean, inside the same frame, think of it like a photocopier. That if you move the paper on the photocopier while the photocopier is doing its scan, you're going to get stretching and artifacts. And this is, to use an analogy, what's happening with the rolling shutter. Now, this...
Yeah, essentially you're getting the top of the frame is captured at a slightly different time to the bottom of the frame. So there will be a sense of movement from the top to the bottom, which is part of this, shows the artifacts.
Yeah, most people think of the rolling shutter as being a skew artifact, though in fact the same thing happens if you're like tilting up rapidly. Because if you're tilting up rapidly, you can actually get a kind of compression and expansion of the world, because, you know, if you're panning one way, or sorry, tilting up one way, it'll squash something. Now, the squashing and the stretching, not so obvious, but the skewing side to side, normally you don't kind of notice it that much. Now, people have started, you know, discussing this in terms of the shutter speed, like saying, oh, well, you know, it only happens on these certain shutter speeds. And that's really not true. It's pretty much happening across the board, but obviously these things are related. And it is quite
a serious... if you increase your shutter speed, then I guess it's going to be less evident.
Well,
for a shorter shutter speed.
Yeah, there's a bunch of things you can do into your shutter speed, and these are all. So let me put this back up one second. What we're talking about with the rolling shutter is inherently part of the CMOS chip, that just doesn't go away. There is menu adjustments on your RED that adjust other things, but there's one other thing I want to get to just before I go to those, and that's partial exposure. And this is the case where if you fire a flash off and the flash is a very short duration, or it starts at a point when the scanning is already half down the frame, you can actually get a frame with a partial exposure where the bottom half has the flash kind of evident and the top half of it was still dark, or vice versa.
Right.
And that's pretty significant, and yet... Again, most of the time, you're not really going to notice it unless the sort of work that you're doing is, you know, high-speed photography relying on a... Is it the Unilux, the, you know, high-speed stuff for doing pouring shots where, you know, that have that sort of... Yeah. So that's going to, of course, really cause problems, because it's a sharp kind of flash. Now, the flash, and there's a decay on the flash, but if you leave the decay out for a second, obviously when it... Even just think about when it starts... If it doesn't start cleanly at the top of the frame, then we'd be out of sync and we'd have problems. Now, there are other artifacts in CMOS chips that that we know about. There's also things in CCD that aren't in CMOS. You tend to get streaking in CCDs that you don't get in CMOS chips.
Yeah, but we're never going to get rid of it. You know, there's obviously the people saying, oh, God, when's the next build going to get rid of rolling shutter, or how can we get rid of it? And it's really, you know, it's just something we have to live with, just like you have to live with, you know, the strobing in film. It's just part of the system.
Yeah. Well, now, you theoretically, you see, we'll get the same strobing in a RED camera that you will in a film camera, because that artifact actually is the same thing happening in both cases. So that's why I was calling you on. I think that the rolling shutter is different, because it's an actually different artifact that you're not... Now, there is a little bit of effectively a rolling shutter concept happening in a film camera because of the nature of that spinning wheel. But nevertheless,
I guess I suppose I'm more meant it as being that's the red crutch to bear. It's similar in the fact that it's something that is just part of, you know, the way of life of that system.
Yeah, we're buying into it when we buy the camera, and that's just
exactly
tough. Now, there is some stuff on the camera in to do with the shutter menu that some people have been curious about, to do with relative and absolute. And I was using exactly these when shooting our high speed stuff up in the Kung Fu stuff at 120 frames and stuff. So if I want to set my shutter up in a film camera, once I set it to 180 degree shutter, it's 180 degree shutter, right? Like, it just is what it is. And you can't overrun it, because clearly if I go to a different frame rate, it's still 180 degrees. So it's effectively half of wherever I am. If I go to 100 frames a second, it becomes 1/200th, because it's 180 degrees of, you know, whatever I was. I was at 100th, so obviously it splits it in half. Now, if you have an absolute setting on your camera, which is how the cameras first sort of came into being, then what can happen is that you can overrun that. So you can basically say, well, I'm going to set my 1/48th. Now I'm going to start shooting at incredibly high sort of speeds, like, say, 100 frames a second. And, of course, it can't do 1/48th of a second when you're shooting 100 frames a second, right? Because it obviously the best it can do is 1/100th. And so now it tries to stay open for 1/48th, but the best it can do is fully open for the 1/100th, and you get back to a 360-degree shutter. So in other words, it didn't move up at the same time that you moved up your frame rate. And so this is what relative solves. Relative says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to up my frame rate and my shutter in sync. So if you decide to swing the knob to a higher frame rate, then I'll just adjust the shutter accordingly. So it always is, in the film world sense, that 180-degree shutter. And so you might say, well, why the hell do I even want that, right? Like, why do I just not have that as permanent, right? Why not just give up the ghost and say, bugger it, let's just leave it like that? And the answer is you probably do a lot of the time, but except for there's some odd occasions when it's not actually true. And a good one is if you're trying to do ramping. Because if you're ramping a shot and you have the relative shutter going, you actually have to ride the exposure to compensate for the fact that you're now letting in less light each time. And there are setups you can do with ramping, and obviously the camera has ramping built in, where you can use that shutter and the fact that it isn't, it is allowing more or less light in as it goes in absolute mode to compensate for what's happening with actually increasing the frame rate.
Regardless of your frame rate or your frames per second, you end up with, always end up with a 48th of a second shutter speed.
Yeah, like in a sense, you use that that not being able to keep up with itself thing to ride the exposure for you. Now, there are some other issues there, and it's a very complicated trick to do that. But there are reasons why
it's going to change your look, of course.
Yeah, but if you are concerned about having the exposure change during a ramping, which obviously is a big issue, then you know, you may want to do that. And so there are reasons why you'd want absolute, and but having said that, most people would use relative, and probably the only time I'm really prone to get into that is, I say, when I'm doing ramping on stuff and I'm trying to avoid having to ride the exposure, which is kind of, you know, a thing that freaks me out a bit.
Yeah. Now, you can, maybe I'm jumping ahead, but you can actually change the way the camera displays to give you a shutter angle, to give you a shutter degrees of angle.
Just in terms of the UI? Yeah, the UI can express it in terms of degrees, and that's a relatively new thing, I'm pretty sure. It didn't used to do that. I'm sort of used to the the time thing, so I'm okay with it. But yes, I think you're absolutely right. You can do that.
Well, there is, because there will be these two schools of thought. There'll be guys who've come from, you know, the sort of DigiBetaCam world or HVX200 world, who will be happy with sort of, you know, shutter speeds and you know, digital SLR worlds. I guess you'll be happy with shutter speeds as being a fraction, but obviously there'll be the film guys who want to walk in and look at the back of the camera and say, okay, 180 degrees, 25 frames a second, fantastic, you know, I know what to do with my exposure meter. So yeah. I think there is that comfort factor with being able to...
As long as you're on relative, they'd know what they were doing,
yes.
Right? Because a relative
exactly.
degrees makes sense.
So you know that then if you've got a 180-degree shutter and you put it on 50 frames a second, you know that you're going to be having 100th of a second exposure. Yeah.
And, of course, you know, obviously most people listening to this podcast would know very well that the trick for making video look like film is to shoot progressively. Well, obviously, we can't not shoot progressively on the red, but
yeah.
the other huge one is to make sure that you get your shutter correct, because your shutter... As much as I think, you know, interlace can wreck a shot for looking video-y, so can getting your shutter wrong make it look smeary. And the number of
I think that is the number one thing for me that it just stands out to me as being making things look tapey, is that having a shutter speed that looks like it is more than your standard 48th of a second. Anything that looks like just more net motion blur than what you're used to immediately just obviously pings out as being digital to me.
Yeah, but I mean, I must admit, when we were shooting scorpions in almost zero light, we used a complete 360-degree shutter because the scorpion hardly moved. So there was like, you know, they made little movements, but there was nothing that you'd call smearing. And we needed
right.
that extra stop we got by having it fully open as opposed to 180 degrees, because
yeah,
one whole
well,
stop
sure.
is a lot to worth, you know, worth having.
Well, it's fantastic to have that option as in your back pocket to be able to, obviously something film guys have never had, to be able to have something like a 360-degree shutter. You just can't have it, almost getting a whole stop more out of your light if
yeah.
you're doing a landscape or something like that.
That's what we were doing. We were literally pulling an extra stop out of our ass when we didn't have one, shooting in almost pitch black conditions off one LED light. And so, yeah, I mean, I really loved it to death. So
yeah.
If you've got
okay.
any questions on shutters, please just fire it to us from the website at fxguide.com, and we're really happy to answer them. We're also probably be a bit late in getting the show notes out this week just because of shooting commitments, but we'll also put in there some shutter degrees to shutter timings and timings back to degrees, so that if you
yep.
want to see what the conversions are, you can see them.
And there's a couple of links to some rolling shutter examples on if no one's actually really seen the artifact. There's a couple of people have kindly put up some footage up on Red User, so we'll give links to that as well.
Yeah, I must admit, in FXPHD, we did a huge thing on rolling shutters, and I shot extraordinarily bad rolling shutters just to show that you could be done. And
right.
it would completely defeat 3D tracking software. But having said that, you know, I sort of manufactured my worst case scenario, and it's quite startling when you do that. And so, it's not something that bothers me because I don't normally engineer a shot to be bad. But yeah, there's no doubt about it. You can engineer a shot to really demonstrate the flaws.
Yeah.
Hey,
okay, well, I think we've pretty much covered shutters, I guess, have we, Mike?
We have. So let's go to the Red Room, and we're off to Tokyo, as you said, although it sounds like you've done it locally because of the accent.
Yeah, that's right. I was a bit surprised with the accent. Okay, yep, Peter Leeming. Again, we'll put links in the show notes to his original posting, which caught my eye, and to his website, visceralpsych.com. So he's it's just starting to do his direct his own stuff, and one of the first few things he's done is on the Red is an interesting film clip for a Japanese artist.
And I must say, he really researched the hell out of Red before he put his deposit down, didn't he? I mean,
yeah,
it's like background yeah. checks on the stuff.
There's amazingly, you know, some of the guys I've spoken to, they think, should I buy this thing or not? And they go, okay, well, we've got Tim, we've got Jim, and they knew all of the people, and Graham Natras. Everyone sort of said, everyone seems to have really done their homework and said, yep, all these guys are cool. Right, here's my money. So, yes, and he's definitely one of these guys. So, no, it's a great interview, and here's Paul.
Thanks for joining me, Paul. How are you?
You're welcome. Good, thanks. I'm well.
Thanks for joining me in the Red Room.
It's a pleasure.
All right, we'll start off. What number Red 1 do you have, and what made you buy it?
Okay, so my Red number is 378. It was one of the first ones very early. And the main reason I bought it was probably a reaction to having used both film and digital cameras at film school and not being satisfied with the quality they offered and wanting to run independently once I graduated and thinking, well, you know, if I want Hollywood-level quality images, I've got to get a Hollywood-level camera. And about that time, I heard about, you know, the first buzz about Red. It was just that. A lot of people were saying it was a scam. And I said, well...
That's right, it's a fake.
That's it. It's a $17,000 fake that's... Yeah, and then I sort of did some research into the company and thought, well, who's Red? I never heard of Red, but somebody had bought the three-letter domain name, the red.com, which, you know, three-letter domain name goes for $250,000 easy. So, well, somebody got some money there, and I did some research and found out that three people I knew of name-wise that were involved with the project, Jim Jannard, the owner and the founder, who was the CEO of Oakley. So I thought, well, okay, he's a billionaire. So he's got the money at least. Graham Natras, who was a post-production code guru for the Apple especially, and then Ted Shilowitz, who was used to work for AJA, and I knew his name from somewhere as well. I thought, well, okay, these guys are serious players.
You did your research.
I did. Well, if I was going to buy a lot of, you know, spend a lot of money on a camera, I thought I'd better make sure I know what I'm getting into. So I put down a deposit.
So what's your role with the camera?
So my role right now is a bit of everything. I go out with the camera on jobs. I sort of act as a DIT, which is digital imaging technician, and or camera assistant. And when I'm not actually at the camera helping out, which is once it's set up, it's fairly simple and people can get on with it. I usually... I'm doing the backup on set and, you know, if necessary, doing a quick grade on set so that the clients are happy with what they're getting.
And you do direct your own stuff, I've seen.
I do. Yeah, that's my overall goal, is actually directing features in the future at some point. And for now, it's sort of shorts and music videos and things.
Yeah, well, that's sort of what led me to you. I saw the stills you put on Red User of the pop clip you directed. And the images look fantastic. I'll put a link to those in the show notes, but yeah, it just looked gorgeous. I immediately had to sort of find out a bit more.
Well, I'm coming a bit from a photography background when I shoot this stuff as well. So, I mean, the goal was to make it look very filmic and photographic and use the shallow depth of field to good effect. And I'm pretty happy with the way it turned out, actually.
Gorgeous Tokyo light.
Yeah, well, it's the rainy season here in Tokyo right now, so we were fighting the weather the whole time, actually. So it's actually, what we got was pretty good, and right at the end of our shoot, it actually started to rain, so we got lucky.
So, and what else did you buy with the camera?
Okay, so we bought the Red 18-50 lens. It's a 2.8 close focus, T3. Then we bought the production pack, which is sort of a cheaper way to get a set of rods, base plate, hard drive / battery holder, handle and things. And then basically extra handles, compact flash cards, four of them, the Red drive, hard disk drive.
So you're shooting, obviously directing and starting to use it for your own projects. There's a few other sort of short films mentioned on your website, Visceral Psych. Is that's your website?
That's my website, yes.
Right, okay. So they're films that you've done but not necessarily Red?
No, the only thing I've done on Red myself, which is ironic, is this Karuta video clip.
That's right. So most of the time, you're renting it out and coming on set as the DIT for it?
Yes, that's correct.
Right, okay. And so what projects has it been going out for in Tokyo?
So mostly we've been doing music videos and commercials. We're in talks for a feature right now with two camera support, because we are getting multiple cameras down the line. But mostly it's been music videos and commercials.
Okay, so the main way it's generating money for you is you're renting it out and that's funding your own projects.
Exactly.
So for your own projects and for this film clip, perhaps if you can touch on what might be your post path that you've been doing with it.
Yes, so basically we shot 4K 2:1 because my output goal format is CinemaScope 2.39:1. From there we did backup first and foremost, two backups, separate drives, separate locations, and now editing off the proxies. So I'm just using the 1K proxy just so I can see what the shot looks like, basically. Yeah. And dragging those directly onto the Final Cut timeline. What I intend to do is send that back out as an EDL. There's a piece of software called Crimson, which is $200 US, which is sort of actually ironically compensating for a couple of bugs in Red Cine, which is EDL import, which essentially just creates an XML file that's compatible with Red Cine and pulls in your full original 4K files, you know, onto the timeline with the in and out points the same as the EDL from your Final Cut Pro. And then I'm going to grade in Red Cine until sort of I'm happy with the quality. Pump out a 1080p format into Final Cut for final rendering and output.
Yep.
But what I'm also going to do is create a 4K master, probably as DPX files, just because what I'm planning on doing is having a 4K premiere here in Tokyo and inviting sort of all of our clients and interested parties to actually see a full workflow at 4K. What I'm doing is future-proofing myself by holding onto a 4K master.
So is there a place there to screen it in 4K?
Yeah, there's a few in Tokyo. There's not many. They're all using the Sony SXRD 4K projector. But they use, there's a couple of cinemas that use it, but also there's a couple of universities. And so we'll choose one of those and hopefully be able to do a 4K premiere, essentially.
Sounds great. Well, I look forward to seeing it. Obviously, I won't be able to see it in 4K, but it'd be great if you were able to somehow post the full length on the web somehow.
Yes, I will be posting the 1080p version online in its entirety.
Brilliant. Are you going to stay with your red one or bump up to an epic?
I'm going epic.
Right.
We were the first red camera to arrive in Japan, and that's been sort of a big bonus because we've gotten sort of a three, four month jump on everybody else. So we've been quite busy. But the thing is, what Red is offering is a full trading price on the Red 1 towards the Epic, and they're doing it in the same reservation number.
Right.
So by having the first Red 1 in Japan, it also means by proxy we'll have the first Epic in Japan, and that is, again, a marketing coup from our perspective. So whilst we'll have multiple red ones at that point with any luck, I'll trade in at least one of them towards an epic so that we have the first epic.
So basically, if you need to rent a red in all of Japan, I guess you guys are it.
Yeah, it seems that way.
Excellent.
I guess the other thing is that this is Sony Heartland, and there's politics involved in these rental companies here who have quite established relationships with Sony and other camera manufacturers here. And we have heard on the grapevine that a couple of them cancelled their red orders. I'm only speculating here.
Someone got to them.
Yeah, as to why. I can't say that's the case or not, but it's we certainly sometimes feel that we're a bit of a thorn in the side, I guess.
No one slashed your tires or anything yet, though.
No, not yet. I have zero complaints with Red One. It is the most amazing camera I've ever used, and to me, I think beats out the Genesis F35. You know, I would happily put that up against every other camera on the market.
All right. Lastly, where can people find you?
Come to Tokyo. No, but seriously. So we have a website. It's the easiest place, of course. It's www.viscerallpsyche.com. I'll spell that out because a lot of people have problems with it. It's viscerallpsyche.
We'll put links into our show notes as well,
sure.
So everybody can go there and see the links to not only your website, but also the links to your post on Red User to see these stills of Karuta. Is that the right way to pronounce it, Karuta?
Karuta.
Karuta, okay.
Yeah.
That's the name of the artist.
That's the name of the artist. The actual title of the song is called Japonica. She is an electronica artist, but using very traditional visuals with her stuff. I mean, somebody likened it to Björk, essentially, so it's kind of that electronica, interesting, out there sound.
Can't wait to see it.
No worries.
Okay, well, thanks for your time, Paul. It's been great to have you here. Thanks.
No problem. My pleasure.
Well, thanks for that. Again, Jace, that was great. And if you want to be part of the Red Room, please send us an email. We can't do everybody. And to be frank, I probably shouldn't even suggest that you send an email because we've had a lot of people send in emails. But we're trying to pick interesting places, unusual people. And we're trying to go for those people that aren't obviously ones that can get a ton of PR. We're trying to get, for want of a better term, the red cameraman in the street.
Well, if you've got a red story with a twist, or if you're using it in an unusual way, or or if, especially if you can talk underwater, love to hear from you.
Now we're going to get back to our pimping your red. And we have a good red pimp. In fact, it's so good that I actually want it myself from Monster Cine. Do you want to tell us what it is?
Yeah, okay. Well, they've got this cool thing called the Hydra Clamp, and they're going to give us one of those to give away to a red user. It also comes with a quarter-inch or a 3/8 spud, which is essentially an adapter that goes into that thing. Now, I'm not going to talk too much about it, because part of the idea is to go there, go to Monster Cine's site, and sort of find out what the Hydra Clamp does, and come up with an interesting five-word phrase that describes the Hydra Clamp. Make it cool, make it interesting, silly, whatever you like.
It's unlikely that... It's unlikely that really fucking cool red thing is going to win. It should actually describe what the product does, but it doesn't have to be, the funniest play on words in since history. So you stand a really good chance of winning this, and it's worth like $250, right? Like it's
And it's cool.
Sorry, big thanks to Jim Clark for doing that.
Yes, thank you, Jim. Good man. And as I say, those guys are really thinking and doing some stuff. We don't have any tie-ins with these people. We just, you know, I just review gear that I think is pretty cool. And if people want to, you know, give stuff away, then great. So, yeah, it's not a sponsor or anything. They're just cool people out there in the community.
They're sponsoring the giveaway, but they're not giving us any anything else.
Exactly. Just so people know. Clear the air there.
And...
Yep, go ahead.
So that's really good. So send those in. And we know that there's a lot of interest in this podcast. In fact, apart from anything else, on Twitter, there seems to be an entire... though probably the single weirdest email I ever had from you, Jason, was the one I got when I was in China, which just killed me laughing. Do you know what I'm referring to?
I forget the guy on Twitter, I'm afraid, but he said, "My girlfriend and I just totally started making out to Red Sand episode 4, which left me sort of speechless. I wasn't quite sure how to reply to that one. She must really like Red.
Yeah, actually, Jonas is the person that did it, Jonas, and you know, thanks for sharing. When I told my wife about that. She had the, because I was like, yeah, man, we're like Barry White, right? Look, yeah, you know, people get off to listen. And she was like, right, so that was because the girlfriend was so bored that she wanted to distract
that's
him.
That's right. She's bored shitless. I was like, no, she didn't say, quick, no, play me episode 4 now, Mike.
No, she didn't. My wife was much more down to earth than that. She was like, you boys need to get out more. So, but we think you're marvelous for listening to Red Center. So we thank you so much. And if you guys didn't listen, we wouldn't do it. And we have a ball doing it. So we owe you one. So thanks, guys. It really is cool that you guys are interested in doing this. And we've been trying to, you know, focus our attention on doing it as, as much as led by what you guys want as we can. So look, we're going to have to wrap up because we're running out of time. But, you're shooting next week, I think, back in Melbourne?
I am. Yes, I'm off to Melbourne to shoot. I can't seem to escape babies and children. And whenever I do that, yes, we'll be shooting with a couple of reds. So that should be interesting. Hopefully I'll come out the other side alive. Definitely earn my money when we're doing kids. It's does your head in.
Switch the camera on, don't switch it off.
Exactly what we want it for. Don't turn it off.
And yes, and I'm shooting, as I said, in Adelaide for FX PhD,
right.
Which has just started the new term. And as I said at the top of the show, we obviously have the red class and some of the other ones, but there's just a ton of cool stuff, both some red 101 courses, After Effects, audio courses, even sysadmin stuff, and really cool stuff to do with 3D tracking, compositing, 3D. And our general subject this term in our background fundamentals is actually on cars, which is pretty cool. We're going to be doing a whole lot of stuff because I don't know... Obviously, Jason, you're aware SIDGRAPH's coming up in a few weeks. RenderMan's 20th anniversary. So we thought we'd do some stuff focusing on RenderMan in our upcoming term. And I must admit, I love that geeky stuff. And so we shot already some red footage, and we're going to be incorporating, which is where I'm going with this, we're going to incorporate some photorealistic cars using both RenderMan and Mental Ray into that red footage. But we also shot the same footage with the film camera, so we're going to look at how the specular highlights are different between the two, and look at clear coat and metallic paints and BRDFs and just all
and how it all tees up and how it all links in with Speed Racer was a lot of RenderMan, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, and also, but so many painted surfaces are so vital. I mean, look at Wall-E, which is, you know, obviously something that we both think is a brilliant film.
Yeah.
You know, same thing, painted surfaces. So getting good painted surfaces looking really realistic, and every day Money in the Bank is doing car commercials. So we've all been doing those for years. So, yeah, it's astounding how good you can get it. And we've got some great help from our friends at both Pixar and at Mental Ray in Germany, Mental Images in Germany. So, that's all cool. So that's all coming up in fxphd.com. But awesome. For now, fxguide.com is where you can find out more and send us stuff for info and stuff. Or you can follow my Twitter feed, which is Mike Seymour, or yours, Jason, which is?
Wingrove. Straight Wingrove, or go to my website, jasonwingrove.com.
Brilliant.
Thanks, mate.
All right. Well, like, so good talking to you. I hope you get some snow. And... We'll chat when I get back from Adelaide, and I'll be able to tell you how it was on the motion control rig.
Great. I'll be on the other side of my shoot and maybe have some red chat for that. We'll be speaking to, in the interim, we'll also be speaking to one of the DIT guys who'll be coming off, who's just come off the Alex Proyas film as well. So I'll have an interview with him, and so that'll be a good one.
Brilliant, brilliant, excellent. All right, well, look, until next time, guys, thanks again, and we really, really appreciate your support, so thanks. We're going to go now, and I'm certainly exhausted from China, and I know you have a log fire to put your feet up in front of. Until next time, we'll talk to you guys later. See you.
Cheers. See you.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us, red@fxguide.com. Copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC.